Good afternoon. So last time, we talked about kind of the patterns that make sandboxing end up being ineffective in practice, like not super ineffective, but you know, it's not a foolproof solution in practice. And we saw kind of two different patterns that come up. So one is that we have these intentionally allowed interfaces which have these unexpected interactions. So we saw this with my example of the Docker escape, where the things that were intentionally allowed were accessing kind of the meta, the information about processes for utilities like PS and debuggers, which we wanted to work inside the sandbox for something like Docker. It kind of gives us a virtual Linux system. You know, having some unintended consequences when combined with the functionality of sort of running a new program in the container from outside. Or we saw the same thing with our kind of example with sort of mobile OSs, where we had some permissions that like ended up allowing us to execute clickjacking attacks because we could draw over something and also read what was underneath. And this ended up being kind of giving more permissions than intended, even though kind of all our sandboxing settings worked as documented, as described. The other category, which we can give more specific examples, is that the interface the sandbox provides can have sort of classic exploits in there. So just like we might imagine kind of a browser might have a bug where there's a buffer overflow where you, if you load the wrong web page, it causes the browser to do something weird. The interface between the renderer process and the what Chrome called the browser kernel might have similar bugs. And we also mentioned kind of the other issue with sandboxing, which is kind of configuring the sandbox to actually have the right permissions, especially when thinking about kind of the type of sandboxing that is maybe the most common today, which is not the kind of privilege separation idea we saw where we divide up an application into pieces, but the idea that we take our whole application and just run it with limited access to things it shouldn't need. We saw there's some nice tricks we could do, like the idea of, you know, we can have a reasonable compromise between it has access to all my files or none of it by kind of giving a privileged file access dialog. But there were these challenges, which, you know, kind of reflects the way that current mobile OSs work, especially, where we have problems explaining what permissions we can give applications actually mean. You know, that if we have fine-grained settings, it can be hard to explain, like, is this giving access to make phone calls or to figure out who I called in the past or just to know my phone number, right? Those are all different settings. And it's hard to concisely explain to the user what's happening. And also, because these settings are complicated, it's a lot of extra work for application developers to sort of request the right permissions. And often they get it wrong, and usually the way they get it wrong is they request permissions they don't need. So if you use modern OSs, you notice one big mitigation they've used for both of these problems is sort of delaying the permission requests until just before it's needed, and also kind of actually lowering the number of permission settings that are exposed from sort of what it used to be, because, you know, it's not super useful to have all these sort of fine-grained types of access if people aren't using it and don't understand it when you ask them about it. We also briefly talked about doing sandboxing without OS help. I mentioned kind of our most prominent example was something like WebAssembly, where the idea is we compile like normal C code to something we can run in a web page, And how do we do that? Well, we don't actually run that code, you know, directly like a normal application, but we also don't run it in one of the sandboxing technologies we described earlier. Instead, we use something more like a language virtual machine, something like the Java VM, but we sort of build a language that we can target with our C compiler that's nice for the C compiler to target, and where we can insert the checks that are necessary to make sure we don't sort of access the wrong program's memory. But we don't actually like fix buffer overflows, or in general, we just make sure the buffer overflow only breaks the C program. And that was kind of practical. So questions about things we covered last time? Okay. And so one note on the quiz, so question three was asking about what we can do with privilege separation. And this is the idea, we run sensitive parts of the program with less access. And the main goal of this technique is to limit the effect of kind of traditional exploits. So for this reason, this should make the stack canary leak a lot less concerning, because with out privilege separation, if an attacker knows the stack canary, they now can take a stack overflow and fully exploit the application. When we have something like a current web browser with privilege separation, most likely your stack buffer overflow, that if you execute it successfully, is going to give you access to the renderer process or something like that, and you'll actually have a lot of extra steps to turn this into a useful exploit. So what used to be like, you get this, you're set for all your stack buffer overflows, is now you get this and you still have a lot of work to go. The other thing is, there are a lot of, yeah.
I think you're right, but I just want to say that I felt that this was a little bit I kind of misinterpreted this, and I felt like the question was a little ambiguous. I feel like it makes it less useful, and more than it makes it take more effort to exploit. But I think the often the potential is similar. And
I probably should talk to my TAs about what they think to get my second opinion. But I think in practice, like generally doing these sorts of, doing like a classic stack buffer over exploit is less likely to be a good path for the attacker, is what I'd say, right? In that, in order for that to work, to have like a full exploit, you need to now have this extra step, which might not always be possible. But yes, I agree. I'm not sure like how I should have phrased the question as what I'd like to know, right? That's usually what I like to ask when we have these ambiguities, is what should I phrase it like next time? And I'm not sure what that is. I'll try to talk over with my TAs and see what they think, and maybe we'll drop something. The other one is on SQL injection. So if an attacker finds SQL injection, privilege separation doesn't change that we're running on the database, and you have to have all the access the application usually has to the database. So that exploit is just as useful as it is with or without privilege separation, right? The code that actually is running the SQL is running with the same access to the data, which is all you're going to kind of get out of an SQL injection exploit. So other questions, yeah. So yeah, I'll, tomorrow with my TAs, I'll ask about what we think about the ambiguity questions. So our next topic, I'm gonna talk a bit about doing bounds checking. Right. That if we just fix C to do bounds checking, a whole number of exploits wouldn't happen. Right, we'd be worried about, a lot fewer categories of security flaws. And mention this example, that if you run this code, this when you compile this on a current modern Linux system, or it actually compiles to a version where it has checking. In particular, in this case, when I compile this with on Linux, this turns into a call to this special memcopy check function, where our arguments are our buffer, our attacker controlled in RDI, the intended length, and this extra argument of 42. And that means the memcopy check routine can do a check to make sure length and 42 don't disagree with each other, and if so, crash the program with a message like buffer overflow detected. And this feature is controlled with Linux, with GCC and Linux, or GCC and Clang, same stuff. With the fortify source macro. And most current systems set it to probably 2 by default, or at least 1 by default, probably 2, maybe sometimes 3. So there's these different levels. So level 1 only does things that should be backwards compatible. So most notably, we didn't talk about format string vulnerabilities. Who's heard of format string vulnerabilities? A few people. So the summary of format string vulnerabilities is that this, so printing an attacker, printf with an attacker controlled format string, you know, obviously this does weird things if I like have %d as my attacker controlled string. And you kind of think, well, that probably means the attacker can read memory they're not supposed to. And that seems pretty useful, seems like a great way to get around stack canaries. But it doesn't seem like it actually like is like a full exploit. The problem is that printf has this wonderful feature where we can use %n to record how many characters we've printed so far. I don't know of why you'd want to use this feature, but it exists in printf in the standard and therefore is implemented. And kind of the intended use is that you like do something like, you know, print something, and you like print a string and a number, and you get the actual length that was printed into a variable passed via a pointer, which means we're writing into an argument. And it turns out, I have slides I can go over this, but you can turn this into basically a full, you know, write memory anywhere you want exploit, and that kind of gives you arbitrary code execution. Fortify source also protects against this, where when we enable setting 2, one of the things it will do is it will make sure printf, if it has a format string of %n, gives you an error if the format string isn't a constant. But this is only done in mode 2 because technically this can break some programs that had some legitimate use for %n, and for some reason we're computing the format string at runtime, but using %n, there might be some program there out there that does that, and we can't just enable this all the time. So things like that are potential quote-unquote legitimate uses of these dangerous features are the reason why there's this separate level 1 and level 2. And there's also this level 3, which is a very recent addition, where it will do some cases where the size is sort of needs to be computed dynamically in some way, and therefore the performance cost is probably a bunch higher. And as for, is there a performance cost? Well, yes, there is, because if we think about our performance cost here, we have this extraction, and in memcopy check, we have some compare and jump, right? So there's a performance cost to doing these checks that, you know, we're gonna have to eat, but the thought is that for something like this memcopy, that's trivial, especially since usually these memcopies are like 1,000 bytes. So who cares about an extra comparison? But, you know, if you do this enough, it obviously starts getting sketchy. So, yeah, so this means that we kind of do a bunch of things, and if the compiler can easily figure out the size, it can add the extra checks. So if it's a local variable with a fixed size, it can even do some interesting cases, like we have a pointer to the middle of the value, it can figure out, oh, that's where that is, and can do the computation. But there's some cases which are obviously trickier. So with level 3, it does this case, where we're pointing to the middle of a buffer, but where we're pointing varies. So that's one of the cases which involves some computation at runtime. Oh, and I don't show why the, sorry. And I missed some context for this. It will compute the minimum of the two things there, needs to do that at runtime. And you can imagine that this gets complicated. And as for does the compiler figure out how to compute the value? Well, it's using its optimizer, which is designed to simplify expressions, but that's not always gonna work. Right, so if we make this complicated enough thing, it's not gonna happen. And we also have a case like this where we have two different sizes. With Fortify Source 2, it will do a bounds check for the memcopy, but it will do it based on the maximum possible size. With Fortify Source 3, it actually like figures out which size it is, assuming you enable optimizations. So this seems like it solves like a lot of trivial buffer overflows, but obviously there are some important cases it doesn't deal with. So one of the biggest problems is that it's based on sort of knowing where something is allocated. So in this case, the compiler says, well, I don't know how big the thing f points to. You might say, but it's a struct foo. Of course we know how big it is. It might be an array, that's the problem. So the compiler just gives up, doesn't know how big that is, and doesn't insert any bounds checks here. And let's say it does know the size. So in this case, it's a global variable. We know exactly it's not an array. The compiler inserts a bounds check for the size of the object f, making sure we're not overflowing the object f. And that's not really what we care about, because we know from talking about pointer subterfuge that that's a pretty dangerous overflow without going out of the buffer. But this kind of checking, it's just looking at the size of the thing that was allocated, and that's it. And so if we don't know the size because it's allocated somewhere else in the code that the compiler is not seeing when it's compiling this, it's not going to help, and it's not going to handle these internal buffer overflows, which are probably almost about as bad as our normal ones. So that's, you know, and that's kind of how it works, is that there's this object size and dynamic object size function, and that's how it's implemented, is using this special object size or dynamic object size function, which doesn't always work. And only tells you the size of the whole thing rather than figuring out, as we as humans can do here, and say, well, you know, we definitely shouldn't be writing past the end of buffer one, the part of the struct. It just says we shouldn't write past the end of the struct. So questions about this fortify source? So I'm showing you that this is kind of limited, but it's really valuable in that this is doing something which gets rid of a lot of buffer overflows with very low overhead, and all you need to do is recompile. And the other kind of issue with buffer overflow, so I think we've, do we cover this in, who has seen discussion of string end copy in 3710? So that's sometimes covered. So I will probably skip over that since you've mostly seen it before. But let's talk about language level bounds checking. So you know, we can do like actual bounds checking, and I'll show examples in C++ and Rust here because these are actually compiled to assembly. So we don't need to argue about, like, you know, we can't do this because this is a compiled language. You can absolutely do bounds checking in a compiled language, and both C++ and Rust kind of support this. So if you use a C++ vector, which if you don't know C++, this is basically like an array list in Java. It has two ways of accessing elements, one of which actually throws an exception if you go out of bounds. It's not the default because it's slower. In Rust, they decided to make the other choice and kind of the default way of accessing a Rust vector, throw panics, basically the same as throwing an exception. And there's a way which doesn't do the checking, which you have to write with unsafe. Question? There's also a way to do it where it returns an option, yes. That also exists. There's a form of that for C++, yeah. But I'm showing kind of the bounds checking that happens kind of on the natural way of using the data structure that we're used to from C, right? So we can make this happen. And you might say, like, why can't we just make this happen all the time? And clearly the issue is performance. And the other thing is that, like, this exists for, like, classes, but, you know, we don't have it for some other things, especially for, like, classical C code where we're passing pointers around and not vectors, not like array list type things. And this is not for lack of trying. There's been a lot of attempts to add kind of full bounds checking to C. Not just kind of these kind of partial fixes of let's handle like mem copy, string copy, those sorts of things, and make them do bounds checking if the compiler can figure out the sizes, just all the time. So what's the problem with doing sort of just modifying our C compiler to do bounds checking just all the time? What's a challenge? And I guess an obvious challenge is that it's going to be slow. There's some other challenges. So what are some like functionality problems? Reasons that we would have trouble doing this? Yeah. Okay, break existing programs. So yeah, so that is probably one of the major issues. So you say break existing programs, you have to recompile it. So I guess there's a couple issues. So one is, do we have to recompile everything? So if we had a tool which had bounds checking your C, where we could just say, compile your library with the new bounds checking C, and you get it, that would be pretty nice. It's a lot less attractive when these solutions look like, we have this bounds checking C compiler. To use it, you need to have your entire program and all the system libraries it uses be recompiled with this new C compiler. So why would we need to recompile everything? Like, why couldn't we just compile when recompile one library? What would we be doing that would prevent my implementation just adding bounce checking to my C, you know, code from working otherwise? So let's think of, so let's say I have a library with, say, a render image function. What's the prototype of that function? So let's say, and the goal here is that this like takes a PNG and produces out pixels. So that's a library. What's the prototype of the render interfunction? What might it look like in C? Anyone? Yeah. So it takes in a file, okay. So in C, we'll use a file star. Okay, what is it? Anything else? How does it give us an output?
I guess, what are the pixels in this case? Is it the pixels, or is it the whole screen, or
what? I want something I can draw to the screen.
I guess dimensions, then?
So it takes in some dimensions. Okay. And what else? Yeah.
Yeah,
and a buffer to put the output. Okay, this would be kind of a pretty standard interface to use in C, right? We take in a file, we take in a buffer and the information about the size of the buffer, and we're going to access that buffer like an array. So if this is the interface I want to implement, I have a problem here, which is that I have no verification of what the size of that is if I'm the compiler. The compiler doesn't know that it gets a pointer. We don't know how big the thing that pointer points to is supposed to be. And, you know, if we're thinking about how the assembly that calls this function is going to look like, it's not going to pass that information for us. And we can't infer it by looking elsewhere because, right, that buffer might just be something on the stack, and how do we know, you know, what the size of allocations are on the stack? Well, we've done it by hand. How have we done it? We've looked at the machine code, at the disassembled machine code, and figured out where the variables are, or used a program like Ahedra that does that for us. That's not really a viable technique for a library. So making binary compatibility, you know, sort of making existing libraries work as is kind of not really an option if we want to add kind of full bounds checking to C, right? That we're going to have these sort of unnice edges on, you know, in the corners here. So the answer is we probably have to recompile everything because we probably need to pass new information that we're not passing between functions for the bounds checking to work. The other kind of related issue is sort of new calling convention breaks assembly / you know, other languages, right? If we have non-C code that we're integrating, now suddenly all the functions that take pointers are called differently. It's not going to work with our C code unless we go through extra effort. So I think that's the primary issue. The secondary issue is, you know, I alluded to, is going to be performance. And there's two sides of that. There's time and there's space that the techniques we'll use we'll see to do inline bounds checking have a time overhead and a space, sort of a bookkeeping overhead. Let's talk about kind of what adding bounds checking would look like. And this will kind of give us an idea of the kind of why we are really concerned about the time overhead. So if I have this code here, you know, kind of my bounds check that I want the compiler to insert is before we use buffer of I, I want to check that I is not out of bounds. And our first problem is, with this idea, is what do we do when the buffer comes from somewhere else? We clearly want this to work with our modify compiler, but we're missing the information we need to make this work. And probably the kind of simplest idea for adding bounds checking that people have explored is, well, we need to know what these two values are, right? So our idea will be to pass in, you know, kind of a buffer min and a buffer max, kind of along with the buffer. So rather than just passing in one pointer, we'll pass in the pointer and the range that it's that we can adjust it to point to. And for replacing these unknowns here, it would be most straightforward that for that to be an integer. Probably in practice, we'll just have pointers to the beginning and end of the array. And so when we pass pointers around, we'll pass them kind of as this structure instead, where we have the actual pointer value and the range at which we can adjust it to point. And our compiler can very mechanically sort of adjust code when we create pointers to actually create an instance of this struct. You know, because generally when we take the initial pointer, we can figure out what the correct bounds are. There might be some corner cases, but we're not doing this, and that's, we'll ignore those for now. But for, you know, this kind of makes normal C code just, you know, work. And in that case, if we think of, say, I want to have a string copy that looks like this, I can have a string copy where I pass these pointers with my minimum and maximum information, and I can just insert all the checks. And here's where we see, like, why the performance is a problem. Right, that if I just naively insert all the checks, I have what is usually, if we think of this as assembly, this is like a move something in dest to a temp location, move the temp location to source, and increment I, and maybe, or maybe like really it's kind of increment dest, increment source might be how it compiles it. So this is like four instructions of actual work, which we need to surround with 5 instructions, because we have this 6 instructions of work, which we need to surround with another 6 comparisons plus conditional jumps. You know, so we've like tripled the number of instructions we're running. Probably not good for performance. In addition, we also have the overhead that if we think of passing our pointers to this function, you know, previously we had just copying 2 numbers into registers, now we're copying 6 numbers around. And also we've done something similar for like if we have pointers in a struct, now those take up 3 times as much space. So this, you know, is something we can do, but probably one of the big reasons people haven't done it is that when you do the straightforward thing, not only do you need to recompile everything, everything now becomes a lot slower and a lot bigger. The other issue is that this technique I showed you is kind of making assumptions that code doesn't do things, that certain things that code in fact does. So as one example, I have a series of slides on things C programmers do that are very unfortunate, but are things you need to handle if you want to make a general sort of safe C. So one thing is that there's this neat pattern here where I really like to have a variable and its struct. So I want to have a string which has a reference count in it. So this is something that FreeBSD's bootp, which is a something like a DHCP server, if you know what that is, for where the idea is we have like some embedded device that needs to boot off the network. This is a server for that. And in that, they have variable length strings, which they implement by having the struct where they deliberately have an array of one byte that, when they malloc the struct, is actually has extra space. And this is not the only piece of software that uses this pattern. I've seen this more times. But if we want to make our kind of fuzzy pointer stuff work, we need to deal with the fact that they're going to intentionally take pointers to string and assume they're bigger, even though that's not what the struct looks like. And if we were thinking of solving the overflow, you know, this overflow, this seems very disappointing for how are we going to figure out the bounds that make sense if they're deliberately doing things where they deliberately stay within a struct's allocation but go outside the struct to do this trick. Another example, so Perl used to be a very popular sort of Python-like programming language, maybe less popular today. And Perl has a way of storing a scalar value that represents a value in the Perl language, which can be like a string or a number, and so on. And often code that kind of integrates Perl with C code might need to stash a C pointer somewhere. So what is often deliberately done is the pointer is converted to an integer and stored in a normal one of these Perl value containers, and then converted back to a pointer later on. And this totally doesn't work with our scheme of encoding pointers, because it assumes we can store a pointer in an unsigned long integer. And Perl is not the only software which tries to use this kind of trick, unfortunately. Or another example, if you want to do object-oriented programming in C, you might want to have like superclasses and subclasses. And a kind of natural way of implementing it is you'll kind of make this subclass here that has the superclass as the first element of the struct. And that means that if we think of our subclass object, that it contains the superclass here. And we can do this thing where we, if we know we have a pointer to something that was allocated as the subclass, we can just cast it. But if we're thinking of our kind of pointer thing we were doing, now I need to deal with kind of deliberately churning this pointer into the outer one. So these are all ugly things that, you know, are another reason why we haven't seen many successful implementations of this, is that all these patterns, if you want to deal with a non-trivial C code base, you're likely to encounter some version of them. But there has been work on this a while back that, you know, exists. I don't think there's a currently maintained version. And they did this kind of fat pointer thing. They did some extensions of it to like make it more efficient. So probably the biggest thing is they tried to avoid using fat pointers most of the time. So they have this kind of idea that if I know the pointer won't ever be used for an array access, let's just keep it as a one thing. And they also had a special type to handle this pattern. And they needed some source changes. They were not just recompiled because of these weird things C programmers do, like what I showed you, and also to like handle library calls that might not all be stranded. And their performance numbers, from a research point of view, were pretty good, but I don't think you're going to convince many people in industry to use something where, for some application, for some like realistic benchmarks, the time overhead is runs 2.5 times slower. For some things, it runs basically the same speed, but some things it's 2.5 times slower, which is very bad. Right. But that's kind of what's going on there. And I would say, like, that's why I started by teaching Rust, because that seems to be more the direction people are going as far as sort of doing bounds checking all the time, is using languages which are better at kind of having that built into the code, rather than trying to like use tools that add it on top of existing C code. So that's kind of the compiler solution. So there's been a number of solutions that are kind of trying to be lighter weight. And I'll talk about one, and I guess I'll talk about two sort of such things. So one, I'm gonna talk about this research paper on baggy bounds checking. And this is trying to do kind of runtime bounds checking that's more efficient, but not using, without like big source code changes. And trying to more deliberately be backwards compatible, not just sort of in fast. And I'll also talk about Address Sanitizer, which who's used Address Sanitizer besides which I hope was more people because of the fuzzing assignments. Talk about what Address Sanitizer does, and as we'll mention, Address Sanitizer is not a security solution. We'll talk about why doesn't it protect us from buffer overflows. We just turn it on in practice. So baggy bounds checking and does this thing, which is similar to what Address Sanitizer does, where the key idea is rather than keeping with every pointer the size of the thing it points to, we'll have a giant lookup table in which we can look up the size of an object. So we won't pass around extra minimum and maximum information. Instead, we'll look it up at runtime. So this has a problem that it can't kind of represent overflows within a struct or anything like that, but it can still kind of represent object sizes generally. And the idea is that when we want to do pointer arithmetic, we'll just make sure that we're in not going outside the object that we're originally in. And we'll use this lookup table to make sure that, you know, if I'm doing string of I, that string of 0 and string of I, based on that lookup table, should be in the same object. And I'll know that because the lookup table will tell me where the object starts, and I'll use that to figure out, okay, do both of these part of the same allocation or not? Some questions on this idea? And so what we're doing here is our lookup table size has one value for every 16 bytes of memory. And that is what they did. To make this more efficient, they made each lookup table entry be 1 byte. And to make that practical, they decided all object sizes are going to be a power of 2. That if you want to allocate 1,000 bytes, sorry, you're allocating 1,024. But this meant all the object sizes are a power of 2, and that table just stores the power of 2 they are. And it also means that the code with bitwise operations to find the start of an object given its table entry is pretty small. Because in addition to being a power of 2, they all start at a multiple of their size. And it lets us do this nice bit fiddling to find the start of the object. So each object's allocated in one of these power of 2 size slots. And the table kind of tells us, you know, we can look up any part of the object allocation and get the size of its object by it because we filled in the appropriate table entries. And objects that are bigger than our minimum size are going to have multiple table entries in use. So questions on this, the way this table works? And so we just need to allocate objects at powers of 2 and fill in this table. For malloc and new, new would be C++. It seems fairly straightforward to do this. We're just changing how malloc works. Right, and I have the examples there. And I guess we have padding that malloc and new need to do. We also need to handle this for stack allocations. Which means that they modified the compiler, so when we generate stack allocations, it's going to fill in the table entries for it and also align the allocations in the stack so the table entries are meaningful. So this kind of lookup table idea, this is also the idea, as we'll see, that kind of underlies address sanitizer, though address sanitizer uses a sort of different implementation. But you might say, how do we store this giant lookup table? And the key reason why this is viable is we only need to store the allocated parts of the table. So unallocated memory, like we just don't have allocated at all, and the space usage is reasonable. And as I mentioned, their idea was that they would check pointer arithmetic. So this is actually different than our fat pointer idea, where we were checking when we dereferenced a pointer. Here, they're checking when you do pointer arithmetic. They make sure that we're not going into another object. So that's kind of their idea. They just check all the pointer arithmetic and trigger an exception if it goes out of bounds. This is not super low overhead, but this turns out to be probably better overhead as far as time than that fat pointer idea. Space-wise, maybe not so great, right? We're making this big lookup table that has to be in a particular place in memory, and we still have the problems that we kind of need to recompile all the code to use this because our stack allocations now need to be sort of set up in this special way. So let's talk about sort of space overhead. As our last topic, what's the space overhead of this technique? So I have 1,100 byte objects. So each of these we have to allocate 128 bytes to make it a power of 2. So that is going to be probably 28 times 1,000 unused bytes. And here I have to allocate 64 bytes to make it a power of 2, plus 6384 times 1. Right, so I have that much space just because I need to allocate powers of 2 to make this table lookup really efficient. This is getting rid of a big part of the speed problem we had with the fat pointer idea, but at the cost of a space problem. And also for the table, I need, 128 times 1,000 plus 384 divided by 16, because I have one table entry for every 16 bytes. Total bytes, 16 bytes per entry, per one byte entry. Yeah, guess these numbers. So we'll talk a little more about this next time. I'll give the preview of their results, which is kind of, I'm not aware of them or modern. I haven't checked super carefully, but like, not aware of things that do way better than this. And you can see this is probably still not really acceptable for run-of-the-mill commercial software and imposes all these other restrictions. So that's where I'll finish up today. More about it.